This is an 8-iron, and it's a dead shank.
Wow.
Way right.
Oh, takes a hop off the path.
You got to be kidding me.
Very tough pitch shot right here. You got to hit it into the hill. One hop up and bite, and it's in.
Kind of like that.
Well, I would like to welcome to the podcast four-time PGA Tour winner, Bob Estes. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Sure. Looking forward to it, Jason.
Well, you're coming off a really solid week at the Bowen Classic. Your game must be feeling pretty solid. Anything you're working on right now, or is it sort of all systems go for the rest of the season?
No, it's definitely not all systems go. I've been through a lot with my game the last year and a half in particular, and definitely planning on working on some things with my setup, equipment, things like that for the next couple of weeks. So before I go back out and play a stretch of three tournaments. So yeah, my game has still been evolving. I've been making some changes that I probably should have made a long, long time ago that actually match up better with my body. And so I'm kind of committed to something in my setup with that and looking forward to working on it hard and playing better golf.
So with the season you've had on the Champions Tour, we'll talk about that first, with nine starts and you're 34th in the race on the Charles Schwab Cup. It's really solid. So as a follow-up to that, on the rest of the 2018 season, will you be focusing on the Champions Tour, or will it be a combination of still playing some PGA Tour events and Champions Tour events? And then also, what's your 2019 at this point sort of looking at for next season?
No, I'm pretty much transitioning to the Champions Tour now, but part of that too is because I didn't play nearly well enough on the regular tour when I still was playing on my major medical. I played the last event on my major medical at the Greenbrier about 6 or 7 weeks ago. So I maybe wouldn't even, well, the Champions Tour schedule this fall is pretty full all the way up through the final event on the Charles Schwab Cup playoffs. I think there's maybe one tournament on the regular tour after that, and I'm not even sure if I would get in that or not based on my past champion status. So I'm pretty much just focused on the Champions Tour right now, unless I do something special in a regular tour event that I possibly could play early next year. But I'm pretty much just playing on the Champions Tour now.
So between the two tours, when I was looking at the stats this year, like I said, what you've done on the Champions Tour, nine starts, super impressive. You didn't get the results on the PGA Tour when you played this year. What do you think the difference was between, you know, the flip sides of that, of doing nine events to be where you're at, and on the PGA Tour not getting everything out of it that I'm assuming you wanted to get out of it this season? Is it just too much pressure on yourself to try to perform at the highest level, or is there one tour it's unbelievably good, nine starts, and the other tour you're not probably getting the expectation that you expect when you're out there?
Well, I think the best way to answer that question is I hit the ball really well for the most part on both tours, and just did not putt very well. I've really struggled with the putting this year, even on the Champions Tour. Now, obviously, I've shot some low scores, but I still haven't putted consistently well enough to finish higher than I have. So, no, I wasn't putting extra pressure on myself on the regular tour. I actually hit it better this year on the Champions Tour than I probably ever did at any point during my career, but I just was not making the putts, and there were different reasons for that. So, I obviously, most weeks, the golf courses are a little bit longer and set up just a little bit tougher on the regular tour, but the Champions Tour courses are legit as well. But I think the scoring difference, maybe two, is because the par fives in particular aren't quite as long on the Champions Tour as they are on the regular tour. And so that gives you a few more easier birdie opportunities, you know, per round. And so that's probably a little bit of the difference in the scoring, where I was able to get it up around the green more often in two, or knock it on the green in two, and maybe two putt for birdie, whereas I was, you know, like I said, struggling more with the putting on the regular tour.
What's the biggest difference besides the length of the golf course and, let's say, some of the pin positions or difficulty? I'm playing both tours. In your opinion, what's the biggest difference? Is there is it atmosphere, level of intensity? Is the Champions Tour a little bit more laid back at some level? Or is, in your opinion, what's sort of the biggest difference you're seeing from playing both tours when you're out there, minus the difference of the golf course of length?
Well, I had a couple different thoughts as you were asking that question. Let me see if I can get it all out. But like I said earlier, the golf courses, for the most part, are a little bit longer on the regular tour, as you would imagine, but the setups really aren't that different. I mean, as far as, you know, where they put the pins and, you know, the speed of the greens, and we're still playing golf courses that have some rough on it. It's kind of like on the regular tour. So the main difference would be just a little bit in length, but nothing else. So you might have to ask that question again so I can expound on that even more.
Is the atmosphere a little bit more relaxed on the Champions Tour versus the PGA Tour?
Earlier in the week, for sure. I mean, the guys on the Champions Tour, and don't forget, it's different for every player. But there are certain players that are set for life on the Champions Tour, and there are other guys that are fighting, you know, week to week just to survive and to be able to continue to play on the Champions Tour. So it's more intense for some guys, you know, than it is for others. But it's very competitive, and guys are still working hard at their games, and the level of play on the Champions Tour would surprise and shock a lot of people. Some guys are playing probably as good or better than they played when they were playing on the regular tour. Now, some of that could have to do with there being no cut except for the majors on the Champions Tour, but some guys are just playing some of the best golf of their lives out there.
Yeah, I had Scott McCarron on, and he thinks he's playing as good as he ever has in his entire career in his 50s. He thinks his golf game is better than it ever has been. So, you know, I've gotten that answer a lot of, and I know how good the guys are out there still, but how good the level of play in the Champions Tour still is. And, you know, go walk those golf courses and imagine shooting 6 under par every day for 3 rounds. It's legit. The competition's really good from what I've seen out there.
Oh, it is for sure. And don't forget, I mean, just in these last few weeks, we've had 260s shot. Kenny Perry shot 60 at the 3M. I think that was the second round. And Kevin Sutherland shot 60 last week at the Boeing in the second round. And those are legitimate golf courses. Those scores were crazy low.
Yeah, it's those guys can still play, that's for sure. Looking at your PGA Tour career, and let's assume it's not over at this point. You're planning to play some more events a little bit here and there, so I don't want it to be that assumption, but with over $21 million in earnings, the 4 wins, and basically you've been exempt since 1988, what are you most proud about, or what are you most proud of, I should say, of what you've accomplished on the PGA Tour?
Oh, it's, well, of course, I'm very proud of the wins because it's so hard to win on tour, but I think not necessarily even me, but some of the reaction that I get from other tour players that are younger than me, they're very impressed by, you know, how long I've been on tour because they know how difficult it is. So to basically, I had to go back to Q school a couple of times, but still I was able to play a full schedule or almost a full schedule every year until those couple of years when I was hurt. But for the most part, playing the PGA Tour, unless you're just one of the very, very best players in the world for a long period of time, is just about survival. And so I was able to survive out there for 30 years. And so, yeah, I never really thought too much about it as I was going through the process. But when you look back on it, and you also realize how many players don't have a career anywhere near that long, that's something to be proud of.
Yeah, I don't think the average golf fan, and I talked to Jerry Kelly about this too, of realizes, you know, you played 656 events, like how hard that is to be that good for that long, right? Just to be that competitive for that long, the commitment, the time. If I look back at your career, that's what I'm most impressed with on top of the wins, is just to be that good for that long against that level of competition. It's actually pretty amazing.
Yeah, it takes a lot of hard work, a lot of self-discipline to be able to have that kind of consistency over, you know, that many years. And so But that's kind of the way I was raised. I've always worked hard at it. It's what I always wanted to do. And so I just kept working hard and kept trying to get better.
So let's look at how you started playing the game of golf. Who introduced you to the game, and how did you start playing, and when did your talent really start to come out that there was some potential here?
My dad started me when I was either 3 or, just turned 4, something like that. That's about the time we also moved from Graham, Texas, where I was born, to Abilene, Texas, where I grew up. Dad had me, playing all the sports, and I played football and baseball and basketball and ran a little track. But after the 6th grade, I had to whittle it down to just basketball and golf. So I played basketball through high school as well. But I was playing junior tournaments when I was as young as 5 or 6, I believe, on a par 3 golf course that we had in Abilene. And we had so many, golf was so big in Abilene, Texas, where I grew up. We had so many juniors playing, so many supportive, parents and members of, the clubs and other people at the municipal courses and the club pros. And so, it was just a great environment to grow up in. And, I was playing tournaments and winning tournaments from a very young age.
Was your high school career pretty much a standout? And then at what point did you know that UT was going to be the spot you wanted to play your collegiate golf at?
Yeah, my dad went to Texas, met a cousin that went to Texas, and we played our state high school tournament here in Austin every year. So I fell in love with Austin. And I pretty much knew that I always wanted to play at UT, but obviously I had to get good enough to be able to have that opportunity. So, I was recruited by Houston just a little bit and Oklahoma State pretty heavily. And so basically it came down between Texas and Oklahoma State. And I did take a recruiting trip to Oklahoma State because I did want to go check it out. But it was a pretty easy decision for me to commit to playing golf and going to school at the University of Texas.
Then when you're at UT, great college career, you win the Haskin Award. Has to be a tremendous honor. And looking back at your college career, what point did you know that you were probably going to do this for a living or you were going to go pro?
Oh, I knew I was going to do this when I was 10 or 11. So I made the decision early on. I was definitely in love with golf from an early age. And so, I think I had even written a paper or two when I was in elementary school about my plans. And it definitely was to played off in college and then go straight to the PGA Tour. And so, and like I said earlier, I won tournaments, had success all the way up through high school and college. But I worked awfully, awfully hard in college. I'm not even sure if I could, do 4 years like that again. As hard as I worked at my game, as much time as I spent studying to pursue a degree, even though I didn't quite finish. But my plan was to go straight from college to the PGA Tour, and that's the way it worked out.
Were there some of the guys on your team that ended up playing PGA Tour golf for an extended period as well? Were there some other guys that were out there with you once you sort of made on tour from your days when you were at UT?
Yeah, I think Omar Uresti was the only player that had maybe an extended period of time on the PGA Tour. Obviously, Omar has kind of gone back and forth between the PGA Tour and the web.com over the years and whatever other sponsors were prior to that. But most of the other players or team members, teammates that I had, a number of them played mini tour golf, but there wasn't too much success there. So they all kind of moved on into other careers. So I'm pretty sure that Omar was probably the only one that had other, PGA Tour experience, I guess you could say.
Yeah, and he's still out there in the playing in the Club Pro Championship, beating out by the younger guys every now and then. He still has some game, obviously.
Omar's a really good player, and I don't think anybody loves golf more than Omar does. So yesterday. He's still working hard at his game, and you know, he played a few PGA Tour events this year, and he's obviously played in some of the national PGA Club Pro tournaments and sectional events, and just he just loves to play golf and compete.
So when you go pro, what was the pathway for you to the PGA Tour? Did you do any mini tours, or was it pretty much Q school, then you got your way through it, or how did that process go for you to get yourself onto the PGA Tour?
After the NCAA championships in 1988, I played one more amateur tournament. I played the Texas State Amateur at Lock and Bar in Houston, and I won that. But I knew that I was going to be turning pro the very next, you know, day or week or whatever. And so my first professional event was the Bogey Hills Invitational, which was the largest mini tour event in the country at the time. And that had a $200,000 purse, and $40,000 was first prize. And so I entered that and ended up winning it by one shot when I birdied the last hole. So that's how my professional career got started. So I got off to a really, really good start, but I was only able to do that because I had an uncle and another good friend of his that were committed to sponsoring me from the very beginning. And so, but I played well enough playing that tournament, state opens, a handful of PGA Tour events, and then I did make it through the qualifying process the very first time. So I think they only needed to sponsor me for about a year before I was able to financially do it all by myself. But it helps to have financial backers. It's hard to do it without financial backing in the very beginning.
And then when you get out there on the PGA Tour with that UT connection, who were some of your mentors? Was Mr. Crenshaw and Mr. Kite? Did they serve that role as sort of a Sherpa or a guide for you when you got out there? Or who was sort of your mentors or guys you looked up to when you first got out on tour and learning your way to be a professional?
Yeah, I guess Tom Kite is the first one. Well, no, the first one I should mention is Charles Coody. See, I grew up in Abilene, like I mentioned, and I worked for Charles Coody at Fairway Oaks Golf and Racquet Club in the bag room and picking up the range. I can't remember, you know, how long I did that, but I did it for, you know, quite an extended period of time to give me access to be able to practice there and play the golf course. And so I was also able at times to go play with Charles Coody and his son Kyle, who was also one of my teammates in junior high, high school, and college. And then we had so many other really good players thrown up there as well. But Charles Coody probably, I guess you could say, maybe would have been the first tour player, you know, who I would have been looking up to and learning from. And then after I turned professional, I was represented by an agency that also represented Tom Kite. And so they arranged for me to, I had met Tom before and Ben Crenshaw, of course, but anyway, had a sit down meeting with Tom Kite. And we talked about a lot of things. I can't remember exactly what all was said. The one thing that I did always remember was Tom saying that it takes money to make money. So I guess he was, you know, talking about, you know, not cutting corners or whatever, you know, there's a lot of different things that could mean, yep. But I understood what he was talking about. And so, yeah. And then there were a lot of other players, of different generations, because obviously the PGA Tour has players playing from, you know, in their teens to in their 50s. And so, yeah, there were just so many great guys to you know, kind of model your game or your demeanor, personality, whatever after. I could just go on and on and on. There's just, you know, there's been so many great guys, you know, that played the PGA Tour that have been so nice to me and so helpful, especially in the very beginning.
Yeah, when I was out at Exmoor for the Players Senior Championship, I got to walk 9 holes with Mr. Kite and his caddy and just spend some time with him and pick his brain and, you know, ask him how he goes about his process learning the golf course. What a gentleman. It was one of the most enjoyable afternoons I've ever had on the golf course, of just spending a little bit of time with him. He couldn't have been more kind and you know, nicer to somebody. He didn't need to spend time with me, and he did. Complete gentleman. It was a fantastic day, so I could see how he could be a great mentor to somebody. So you're playing the PGA Tour, and you're out there a few years, and you get your first win at the Texas Open. That had to be extremely special to be a Texan and to knock that first one out in the home state.
Yeah, it was. You know, of course, I just wanted to win anywhere on the PGA Tour, but to win the one closest to where I lived here in Austin, and obviously being called the Texas Open, yeah, that was really special. So I did have some friends and family there, and I was able to share it with them. And so, yeah, that was really special.
And then with the three other wins, you know, to be a multiple winner on the PGA Tour kind of, you know, puts you in a different stratosphere of where the players are at, sort of on the totem pole, and you've done it three other times. Of those three other wins, is there one that really stands out, or looking back, is one a little bit sweeter than the other one, of maybe the way you performed down the stretch or anything like that, or any of them? I mean, they're all great, right? They're wins on the PGA Tour, but does any of them stand out a little bit more than the others?
Yeah, probably the one in Memphis, not just because it was my second win, and that was a long time between wins one and two, but I had become really good friends with a lot of people in Memphis. I've been telling, you know, people for a long time that that's kind of like my third home. You know, I was raised in Abilene. I live in Austin and went to UT, but got lots of really good friends that live in Memphis. And so, because I was staying with a family, the Martin family, from the time I first played there in the summer of 1988, when I got one of those five sponsors invites. And so they had been so supportive of me, and, you know, I'd even gone back at times in the wintertime to go and visit them. And so developed close relationships with a lot of the families there. And so to be able to have so many of them come out and watch me play every year, whether I was, you know, playing good or not, and then to finally win that tournament, that was pretty incredible.
You've played in all of the major championships on the regular tour. Was there a major that you enjoyed playing the most? And what was it about the major that, you know, basically was different than the other ones, or you got up for it the most, or the one that looking forward to each year and out, like that was the one that you really, really loved playing in?
I guess for me, it's probably a tie between the Masters and the Open Championship. Everybody knows how incredible and special the Masters is and the beauty of the golf course, but almost on the other end of the spectrum is the Open Championship. And I qualified for my first one in 1990 when I went over and made it through the qualifier there for St. Andrews. I still remember when I was very young, making sure that my mom or dad woke me up in time so that I could watch the Open as soon as it came on television. You know, sometimes that was, you know, maybe 5 or 6 o'clock, but I just, you know, fell in love with the Open Championship and always dreamed of playing in it. And then to go over there and qualify in 1990, not just for the championship, but for St. Andrews. That was a dream come true for sure. But every Open Championship that I played in, I've loved for the most part. Well, except for maybe the one at Carnoustie where they fertilized the rough and let it get out of hand. Those two tournaments, those two majors are my favorites for sure.
And also kind of looking back at your career, and this question is going to be a little bit long-winded, but, you know, I'm assuming when you started off on tour, you were playing a wooden wood, or at least a small little metal wood with a ball that really spun and it curved. And how have you had to change your golf game as the equipment change, you know, really kind of came about during your career, and even in the, you know, really since, you know, in 2003 when the Pro V came out and the 983 driver with that combination really kind of changed it. Have you had to adjust anything in your swing in your game to sort of coincide with where the technology was going and where it currently is?
Now, this is probably the most interesting thing that we can talk about on your podcast. And I was actually talking with somebody either yesterday or the day before about how much the game changed while I was just coming into my own in 1994. In 1994, and yes, backing up just a little bit, yeah, no, obviously I grew up playing wooden woods and bottle balls and, you know, blade irons and bullseye putter. So, yeah, the game has changed tremendously, you know, since, you know, the mid-90s in particular. In 1994, I was number one in the all-around statistical category. However many categories they had, you know, 10 or 11 or whatever it was, they'd add up the rankings, and then you'd have an overall ranking. Well, I was number one overall at the end of the year, and that's also the year that I won my first tournament, like you mentioned earlier, the Texas Open in San Antonio. In 1995, that's pretty much when the titanium drivers made their appearance on tour. And the first titanium drivers that came out on tour were quite a bit more upright, and they had closed faces, not just the drivers, but the fairway woods as well. And I was a fader. So other guys were having a lot of success with titanium drivers and hitting it further. And so everybody kind of felt like they needed to play one to be able to, you know, keep up or catch up or whatever. But all of a sudden, I couldn't hit the fade that I was playing with either a wooden wood or a small steel-headed driver. I was actually playing a Bridgestone Jays driver those couple of years prior to the titanium showing up on tour. So most of those clubs were anti-slice clubs. So the equipment manufacturers, and they say it was based off computer models, but basically they were clubs designed to not let the ball go to the right, because that's what most amateurs struggle with. And so we were pretty much trying to play equipment that didn't suit tour players. And so by 1996, I think it was, I guess I survived 1995, but by 1996, I was heading back to Q school. So here I was just coming into my own, and I was playing some of the best golf of my life in 93 and 94. And by 96, I was heading back to Q school because I couldn't hit my fade in the fairway. And at times I did go back to playing a wooden driver, maybe the smaller steel head. But anyway, it was a real frustrating time. I think there were a number of players that used to be great drivers of the golf ball and some of the best players on tour. And I think that the equipment change shortened their careers. Some of the guys that come to mind quickly, you know, were Chip Beck, Jim Gallagher Jr. You know, I don't know exactly what those guys were going through with their games at the time, but some of those guys were playing great golf and then their careers were over in a hurry. So it was a real frustrating time. And now the titanium drivers, in particular, since we're just talking about the drivers right now, you know, are adjustable. So you can make them sit pretty much however you want to. So now, and it has been for, you know, a number of years now, the drivers are maybe designed the way I thought they should have been way back in the mid-90s. But it took them a long time to kind of transition from us playing clubs that were designed more for amateurs to clubs that were designed for tour players.
So, I'm old enough where I remember all this stuff. I actually remember that Jay's driver, and that thing sat way old. I mean, yeah, it was designed for the professional golfer. If I remember the Ozaki brothers, you know, I could see how that thing could fade. So let's say Callaway or whatnot is coming out with a titanium driver in the mid-90s. Even for the guys on tour, they did not have a pro or tour version that they made for you guys that they'd open up the face a degree or two. You guys were back then stuck with the same thing they were selling to everybody else.
Yeah, they were just mass-produced, and they were having us play same. And it wasn't just Callaway. The Callaway, I guess, was kind of the leader in the beginning, and then some players were having success. And then other companies that started to do their own titanium drivers and fairway woods. I remember those pretty much looking and sitting just like the Callaway clubs, and you know, no matter which company it was. And so lots of players struggled. I remember playing with Jay Haas at the Masters, who always drove the ball so straight with a nice little draw. And he would hit one left, one right, maybe time one right, hit it in the fairway, then hit another one way right, another one way left, because they just didn't, they didn't sit the way that they were supposed to for a good player. They were just too upright and too close. And so you had to almost hold the face open just the right amount on the way down. And that's not the way to play golf, especially under pressure.
Has your golf swing changed as well for, let's call it the modern equipment, when the drivers got to 420, 440, 460 cc, and you could gain that benefit out of it with the ball not spinning as much? Did you actually have to make changes in your golf swing as well to accommodate for the equipment?
Well, I probably should have. And one thing that I did notice that I should have done earlier is, over the years, I've noticed more and more players coming out on tour with stronger grips. So, you know, I learned to play the game back in the 70s, and my two original golf teachers were Ben Hogan disciples, who obviously was just down the road a couple of hours in Fort Worth. And so I was always taught to try to eliminate one side of the golf course, just the way Ben Hogan did and talked about. And so that was the left side. So I played with a very weak grip and never had to worry about a hook. You know, I might hit a pull occasionally, but anyway, when the titanium heads came out and the drivers got longer, it made more sense to play. Well, and also with the golf ball not spinning as much, it made more sense to play with a stronger grip, because it was hard to get the face back to square on a driver that was, you know, 45 inches long. So more and more players showed up on tour with stronger grips, and they were driving it long and straight. And so golf changed quite a bit, you know, especially, you know, right around that time, 2000, when the Pro V1 came out.
Do you think the golf ball's too out of control at the pro level at this point? Would you like to see more workability and curvature to the ball than what currently happens?
I think it would make the game a little more interesting, and you could almost say a little bit more fair to the medium hitters. I think I've seen something before. I don't really have the stats. I don't know where to, or the numbers. I don't know where to send you to look for it or anything like that. But I'm pretty sure that it's been proven that once you are able to get your club head speed up to a certain miles per hour, you benefit more from the current golf ball than you do if you're under, you know, say a specific club head speed, producing a certain ball speed off the face. So, and obviously you've heard and read plenty about golf courses having to, you know, add tee boxes, remove bunkers and things like that. So, you know, and in a longer golf courses, for the most part, are going to make for longer rounds. And so that's one of the things I, you know, talk about. I mean, I remember back, and I'm not saying a lot of technology hasn't made the game a lot more fun and a lot better for a lot of people and all of that. But, I just kind of remember back when a round of golf took 3 hours, not, you know, 5 or 6. And so golf has changed in a lot of ways for the better, but not in every way.
Would you be okay with a bifurcation of the rules where us amateurs have a certain segment and then you guys have to play at a different level? Or do you think golf should be under one set of rules and we all play by them?
Oh, I don't know. You probably would rather me have a stronger opinion on that, I know. But, you know, I kind of read a lot of opinions coming from both sides, and I don't know what the real answer is on that. Of course, you'd like it to be the same, but the game is so different at the highest level compared to what most average golfers are able to do that, you know, maybe you know, maybe there should be some bifurcation, but I really don't know. I haven't thought about it maybe quite as much as I should have before your podcast.
And then I'm thinking about like the average guy with an 85 mile an hour club head speed. If they brought that ball back, I mean, they'd barely be able to drive the ball 200 yards with them. You know, I could see people just revolting if they, you know, if they took their Pro V or their Srixon XV away from them, right, at the amateur level. I think it'd be detrimental to the, as hard as golf is for most people. I think it would be, I don't know if they'd be able to do it at this point, if they, for the amateur golfers, if they'd be able to pull it back without having serious consequences of people's enjoyment out of it. I know it's an interesting argument, right? I could also flip around the other side and say it's played under one set of rules for this many years and that's the way golf is. So it's an interesting argument or a debate to have on the situation.
Yeah, I mean, it sure is. I mean, would you rather, hit the ball, 10 or 20 yards further and play in, 5 hours? Or would you rather give up that distance and, maybe save an hour per round? I don't know. Maybe it just depends on who you are.
Yeah, it's going to come to a head at some point where they're going to kind of go one way or the other on the in the major governing bodies. It's going to be interesting to see what happens with it. The other follow-up I have from your career, is as long as you've been out there, is working out and what you do physically. So when you first came on tour, did you even work out? Were you supposed to work out in the 80s like that, or was it considered quote-unquote bad for golf? And then how has that transition gone to what you're doing, from a workout standpoint at this point, to keep yourself competitive at, into your 50s?
Well, I did have to alter my workouts about 12 years ago because I was actually working out too hard, and I was lifting too heavy, mainly upper body. I mean, obviously I'm 52 now. So as you get older, your training probably should change somewhat. But I wasn't hitting the ball as well as I knew I needed to. And I wasn't sure if it was because my golf swing wasn't good enough, which it wasn't, or if my training was holding me back because I had gotten too big through the chest and the shoulders. And so as it turns out, it was both of those things. Once I was able to kind of lean out some and lose some of that mass in my chest and shoulders, then I knew that my golf swing wasn't what it needed to be either. I grew up playing all the sports like I mentioned, and I mean, we were working out, in junior high. So I've always worked out. So there are plenty of people that maybe didn't play other sports and all they did was play golf and never worked out. But I've always worked out and never stopped. And when I was in college, our golf team worked with the strength coaches there, or at least the ones that wanted to. So I've always trained, and I've got a great training now that I've had for at least 20 years. Scott Hennig, who was a world-class pole vaulter, And we were just working out yesterday, and we'll be back in the gym today and every day this week. But yeah, there's so much I could say about that, because the training that a golfer does can benefit his game, or it can also be detrimental to his game. You better just have a really good trainer, or be getting really good information from, whatever source. But you need to make sure that it's benefiting your golf and not detrimental to your golf.
So now you're sort of focusing on a little more lighter weight, more explosive movements, more higher reps, I'm assuming a lot more core strength than just purely lifting anymore at this stage of your career?
Well, no, I was doing all that other stuff as well. I just specifically had to back off the upper body lifting because I was trying to lift too heavy. No, I've always had a very balanced training program. And I was trying to get bigger and stronger. And I'm actually probably in the off season going to kind of go in the opposite direction just a little bit, because I probably could go ahead and gain a little bit more upper body strength. For the most part during the year, we're just trying to maintain usually in the off season when I've got more time to just train, that's usually when I was trying to make more gains. But but I've always done all of that: cardiovascular, core stability, mobility, power, strength, all of that.
Well, let's talk about Austin Country Club. What a rich history. And that member must be tough to win. Now they got Sergio down there as a member as well. So have you gotten to know him a little bit? And ACC has to be a great spot to keep your golf game sharp. It's from watching the coverage when they have the event on television, it looks like a wonderful golf course.
It is. Now, the member you're talking about, that was the Austin Golf Club. It is easy to get those two confused.
Oh, that was not at Austin. My fault on that.
That's okay. You're not the first one that thought that they won the member at Austin Country Club. That was the Austin Golf Club. That is Ben's baby out west of town. It's about 25 minutes from here at Austin Country Club, but it's a great course as well. Sergio, I know, either has access to Austin Country Club, or they might have given him honorary membership of sorts. I can't remember exactly, but Austin Country Club is a great club. I can't believe I didn't join sooner than I did. I think I joined sometime in the mid to late 90s, but I should have joined, you know, just as soon as I had a chance. But didn't really, you know. I guess when you have access as a tour player to play just about anywhere you want to, you sometimes don't even think about joining a club because you can go anywhere you want for the most part. But I joined Austin Country Club in mid to late 90s and never regretted it. It's a great place, great course, so many great people, such a family club, and it's such an incredible setting also on Lake Austin.
And you also have a really good caddy on the bag, Chuck Moore. When I'm out there on the couple events I go to a year, which is around Chicagoland, I always like talking to Chuck. He's just fantastic. How did you start working with Chuck, and what does he bring to the team that you most admire about him?
Probably the best thing about Chuck is how, I guess, level-headed he is and how consistent he is with what he does. He doesn't get too excited no matter the circumstances, doesn't get down, doesn't get upset with me if I'm not playing well or whatever. But, you know, he's always on time. He does his homework, and he's just very, very consistent, you know, every day, every week in what he does.
And how many years do you guys work together at this point?
Chuck started working for me in the spring of 2001. That was probably about a month or month and a half, I think, before my second win, my first one with him, which was the tournament in Memphis. But I'd had different caddies up to that point in the spring of 2001. And so I had a couple of different caddy for me, kind of like tryouts. And Chuck was the one that I decided to go with, and we've been together ever since.
It's a great story. Well, I've got just a few more here for you, and I'll let you out. These are just sort of quick fires, and whatever comes to your mind, let me know what you think. So, best three or four golf courses in the world architecturally, and what makes those courses so great?
Well, a few of them I probably haven't even played, and I hope to someday. I mean, obviously, Augusta National is one of my favorites, just like St. Andrews, which we talked about earlier. There have been a number of other Open Championship golf courses that I've really enjoyed playing, like Muirfield and Turnberry and Troon and Lytham and Birkdale, you know, most of the ones on the Open Championship rotation. I still haven't played Royal Melbourne. People speak so highly of that, and I've seen it on television, and maybe someday I'll get to play that one. You know, Cypress Point, we used to play that on tour a long, long time ago, so I played that one a few times. Great golf course, great setting. Riviera has always been one of my favorites on the tour. Those few years that I was hurt and couldn't play it, it was killing me to not get to. And so, I'm sure there's so many more courses that are so well designed and so much fun to play. I haven't played Pine Valley. I've had a couple of opportunities to go play there, but you know, the timing either didn't work out or I was maybe injured at the time. So,
two or three of the most interesting people you've gotten to meet because of the game of golf, and not necessarily golfers, just from what you do for a living and what that gets you access to.
I maybe should have had this ready to go for you, but
well, I can't. That, you know, we got to keep it spontaneous, right?
Well, obviously we get to meet a lot of people that are very successful in their careers, you know, whether it's in the sports world or outside of it. But just some of the names that come to mind quickly are some of my AT&T partners, like Kenny G. Got paired with him. I was working with the same teacher for a while that Kenny was working with, and so got to play with Kenny. But you know, he's an incredible musician, obviously, and known all over the world. Josh Duhamel was a partner of mine 1 year, and so we stayed in touch, and he's had all kinds of success as an actor and a super guy too. I'm just trying to think. I played with maybe my very first AT&T tournament. I should have been able to remember the name, but it's escaping me. But he was a very famous actor, and I know that it was it's very impressive for my mom that I was able to play with him, get to know him. I believe his last name might have been Keeler. One of the famous actors, and I believe Seven Brides for Seven Women. And then obviously there's so many other, you know, people that have, you know, heads of corporations or, you know, people that have been very successful in the business world, but, you know, I'm kind of drawing a little bit of a blank now.
That's all right. Well, if one pops in your head, I got just a couple more here and you can throw it out there. Best golf shot you ever hit under pressure, and what were the circumstances?
Well, there's a number of shots that come to mind. I mentioned that Bogey Hills Invitational Tournament as, you know, my first professional event. I think I was, can't remember if I knew that I was top of the league at the time. I don't think I was in the very last group, but on the very last hole, I hit my tee shot left. And it was a tree-lined course for the most part. I was in the trees. It was a very difficult green as well, very difficult to putt. And I believe it had two tiers to it. But I was in the left trees. I probably did know that I needed to make birdie in the last hole, and there was a small gap in the trees that I had to hit the ball through and hit a cut shot. And I believe it was an 8-iron. So I hit the shot just like I had to, through the small window or gap in the tree branches, ended up 4 feet from the hole and made the putt, and ended up winning the tournament by one. So that one certainly stands out. But then my first tour win in San Antonio, the last hole was a par three. 9 and 18 are both par threes at the clubhouse. But I had a one shot lead on Dr. Gil Morgan, and I was hitting a 5-iron in, and the green, you know, is not that big and a couple of bunkers around it. And I hit 5-iron pretty much into the center of the green, and Dr. Gill hit the green as well. He missed his putt, and then I rolled mine up there and close and tapped it in for par for the one shot win. So I guess those were probably two of the best, because they were my first two wins, my first win as a professional and my first win on tour.
The most raw, talented golfer you ever got to play with in your PGA Tour career, where you were just blown away of how naturally gifted they were at the game of golf?
Well, I guess you'd still have to say Tiger Woods. I mean, obviously he's worked very, very hard at it, but there's just, you can just tell the way he did it. I mean, he was so much more naturally gifted than anybody else, but you can't take advantage of that unless you work as hard as he did also. So I'd have to go with Tiger.
Any great stories in his heyday where you guys went at it head to head, or is there any great Tiger stories you had when he was in that stretch from, say, 2000 to 2008 or so, where you played with him or won at it and great competition or great match or anything like that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty easy to keep up the number of times that you've played with somebody like Tiger or Jack Nicklaus or Arnold Palmer or whatever. But I think I'm almost positive I played 7 rounds on tour with Tiger. And I believe that I scored lower than him 3 of those 7 times. I think one year at the Tour Championship, might have been 99 at Champions in Houston. I think par was 71, I believe. I think Tiger shot 68, and I shot 65. So that was pretty awesome. That wasn't his best golf yet. His best golf started to come around in 2000, but still, he was still Tiger Woods. And, to play with him and, beating 3 shots in 1 round, that was a lot of fun.
It's good stuff. Last one I got for you. If you could invite 3 other touring pros, it doesn't matter if they're from the Champions Tour, regular tour, either one of them, and you're going to go out to your club at Austin Country Club and play a fun money game and have dinner afterwards, what 3 guys are you bringing? What do you admire or enjoy most about being around those buddies of yours?
Oh, is that past or present, living, deceased?
Living. Guys that you could call up tomorrow and do a great game with.
Okay. Oh, and that's such a hard one to answer, too. I mean, like I tell people, there's just so many great guys on the Champions Tour and the regular tour. I hear that question asked a lot, and, I think about it, and it's always hard for me to kind of come up with the names, because there's just so many great guys.
Well, that's a good problem to have, that they enjoy the guys that much out there, right?
Yeah. So if you want and need some names right now, let me go ahead and I'll take Kite and Crenshaw here in Austin, and I'll take one of my all-time favorites, Kenny Perry. He's just such a joy to be around. He's always so nice and having so much fun, so I'll go with that group.
Pretty good group right there. Bob, thank you for the time that you gave us to do the podcast. I greatly appreciate it. And good luck for the upcoming Schwab Cup. Keep playing well. And like I said, thanks for the opportunity to get to talk to you today.
Oh, I enjoyed it. Thanks, Jason.